You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I think auditioning and all of what we do in terms of trying to get a job is like dating, right? As much as they're selecting you, you're selecting them. Like it's a conversation, okay? It is not like I'm here to try to present for you. No, it's a conversation. It's a back and forth. It's a dialogue.
Welcome to the Black Business of Broadway, a podcast brought to you by the Broadway League and Black to Broadway. Here, we highlight the stories, how-tos, and successes of the Black professionals and legends of Broadway. I am your host, Janine Scott. So today I have with me Marchant Davis. Marchant is a Philadelphia native who holds a Master's of Fine Arts from NYU's Tisch Graduate Acting Program. He is a writer, producer, director, film and stage actor who can be seen in Broadway's production of Ain't No Mo. Thank you for joining us today.
It's nice to be here. And the upcoming production of Goodnight Oscar at the same theater.
Yeah, and we are going to actually talk about that later, a little bit later on. So thank you for that. Thank you for that tag. So I want to go back, you know, looking back, can you talk about your path to Broadway and how or when you knew this was something that you wanted to do?
Oh, we gotta get in the time machine and like head back some years.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's go back. I grew up in Philly. I grew up in a church called Bright Hope Baptist Church. William H. Gray III was my pastor. William H. Gray was the head of finance during the Clinton administration, and he was he was like Clinton's right-hand man. And my church just had like most Black churches had like an amazing choir and an arts sort of program. The music director at the church, and the church sort of took me like in high school, middle school, high school. They just took me under their wing. They did that a lot with a lot of young artists there. The music director at my church was also a choir director at Westminster Choir College in Princeton, New Jersey. And so I spent a summer in Princeton through him getting me there for free because my mom wasn't paying for that, you know. It was like, it was my freshman year of high school. And in that summer, I got to see my first Broadway show. So I had to give you all that context to let you know. And my first Broadway show was In the Heights.
I know.
It's wild. It's wild to think that that's the first show I ever saw on Broadway. Guys are like, what?
But what a show.
I know.
To introduce you to Broadway.
Yeah.
I mean, you get to see all hues of folks. And yeah.
And I remember sitting up in the balcony and just being like, I was gasping the whole time. And the summer program was, I was one of very few students of color there. And I think for me, I was just like, I was agog. I was agag. I couldn't believe what I was witnessing because, you know, I grew up on, I never got to go to the theater as a kid. Like, I grew up watching movie musicals, and that's kind of how I got my into performing arts, watching Chitty Chitty Bang Bang with my brother and all of Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, we love you. Me and my brother annoyed my mom in North Philly. Yes, two little Black boys singing Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. That was us.
That's great.
Yeah. And so it was that summer where I was like, this is wild. It was the greatest summer to sort of like have that like injected into my spirit because I was training that summer there at the program. And I think it was then where I was like, oh, I'm going to go to school for musical theater, or I'm going to go to school for theater. It was then where it started to click in my head that this is kind of what I want to do. and that I see people looking like me who make a living doing it. And it just excited me in a way that, like, I think movie musicals did, but, like, it was just, like, practical. Like, I saw it in front of me, and it was invigorating. I'll never forget it. In fact, I think I went back to see In the Heights, the national tour, the second national tour. I saw it maybe three other times after that because of what that show did for me.
That is amazing. You know, your story it's similar to mine. It's similar to so many other folks that I know. I got to see me mm-hmm. on stage, and coming from someplace that's not necessarily, you know, in New York, in Manhattan, mm-hmm. like me in Nebraska, I was watching I'm watching Music Man, the Wells, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, and Bye Bye Birdie, and that was my introduction. And my grandfather actually introduced me to musicals, you know, through film. And it wasn't until I was 16 and I came to New York and I saw Five Guys Named Mo. So I get it. And this is also, I mean, this is why we have this podcast also, so that people who look like us, mm-hmm. you know, get to hear our stories and know that we are here and that there are jobs and that mm-hmm. this is a viable career. And mm-hmm. so I am grateful and I'm thankful to have you. Who along the way helped to support you? Because it can be a little discouraging at times, Ooh. You know, this industry as a whole. Who do you see as your support system? Who's keeping you going? Who keeps you motivated?
I mean, well, one, I just because she's sitting right here, I feel like I have to show you. It's my grandma. And she sits on all my dressers.
I love it.
So that's the start to you know, daughter of a sharecropper, you know, moved up to Philadelphia with her oldest child, and was like, I want more, and made more for her family. My grandma had 12 kids. Wow. So I have a huge family. But then along, like other people artistically, it was like, you know, the folks at my church, Donald Dumpson, who was the music minister at my church, who said to me, oh no, don't look at this program. Look at this program. You can get in for free. They got me into things for free. You know, people who, like, gave me options because my mom was just like, she had three boys, and it's like, and she's a single mom. And so, like, you know, some of the things I would have loved to do, like Carnegie Mellon pre-college, you know, and all those things that I heard people doing once I got to school. But, like, that's not the path that was available to us or to me. So it was folks like Donald Dumpson, it was folks like my grandma who valued education and the importance of it. And then it's like, you know, I have to go back to my church because it's so many people at my church. My church in Philly, it's like, it's so funny. My undergrad, one of the administrators at my undergrad was texting me yesterday because Karen Slack, who's an opera singer, was in Porgy and Bess at the Met and has traveled around the world. She's up there doing a master class, and she actually was a member of my church, and her father is my mentor, and she's one of my mentors. And so it's like it takes a village, man. And
yes, it does.
And I'm grateful for all those folks at Bright Hope who literally paid for my voice lessons. Like, when I was I don't know if I don't know how I'm going to apply for colleges because I don't, like, how do I prepare? And they got together one day before choir rehearsal, and then at the end of choir rehearsal, they presented me with a check.
Shut up.
And I was like.
But that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so it was like.
That's us.
Yeah.
That's us.
Yeah. So it was like that together. Community. And then it's like, you know, and since then, you know, I've had the privilege of going to, I went to undergrad in Boston, and I got my master's at NYU. And the community at NYU is just, I mean, in this show right now, there are six of us. Half of us went to grad acting. One of them was my classmates at grad acting.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. So, small world.
Yeah, yeah. So it's the community that I built there. And that community, I feel, is so important in this business, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. in theater. Because what I'm learning is without that community, you don't really, like, you, half the learning doesn't happen in school. It happens on the job. And if you're not communicating, if you're not having those conversations with people who are doing it, with the folks like Coleman Domingo, who, you know, I remember when he saw it at the Public and I was like, oh my God, I remember seeing you in Passing Strange. And I didn't even see it on stage. I saw the version Spike Lee filmed and I was like, oh, I'm such a fan. He was like, no, 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 sir, I'm a fan of you. And I was like, stop, no, I'm a fan. But like, just realizing, like, once you're a part of that community, you're a part of that community. Yes. And we use each other. And it's a great community to be a part of. And it's important to have open dialogue and conversation.
Yeah. You know, so you have played at least three roles that tell a story about disrupting systems. In The Day Shall Come, you play Moses. Mm-hmm. I was trying to watch a little bit of it before our interview, and I'm like, okay, this is
that's
good. And then The Great Society,
yes,
Stokely Carmichael here on Broadway, and now currently in Ain't No Mo'. We, you know, how do you select your projects? You know, are you drawn by subject matter? Is it the whole body of work? Or, you know, are you driven by the role itself? Or is it a little bit of everything?
I was taught some a long time ago, which is like the three P's. And this is going to sound very like sort of formulaic or whatever.
It's
but
okay.
People play pay. I need at least two of the three P's in order to want to do a project. So if the people are great and the play is great, you do it. If the people are great and the pay is great, you do it. If mm-hmm. the play is great and the pay is great, you do it. So I need two of the three P's. That's like for starters.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I feel like there's always something within it that calls to me. So it's like a bit of a, like, I think I'm different than most in that I think auditioning and all of what we do in terms of trying to get a job is like dating, right? Much as they're selecting you, you're selecting them. Like it's a conversation, okay? It is not like I'm here to try to present for you. No, it's a conversation. It's a back and forth. It's a dialogue. And so I think through all those things, the common thread is that, something on their end was calling to me, but something on mine was also calling to it, whether it be the people that were involved, whether it be the play, whether it be, sometimes I'm going to be realistic, life, you know, and what young people don't know is you need health weeks.
Hello?
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be like that. You're like, will this show give me enough health weeks?
That's real. We like to act as if love can pay the grocery and light bill, and it doesn't. And so it's okay for pay to be a part of it because
at the end of the day, I think what I learned from seeing In the Heights was that these people get paid to do that. They're doing this for a living. Mm-hmm. They get to do this. You know, they get to do this. And so there's a lot of things that draw me to a project. A lot of things. And a lot of things that draw a project to me, you know? Mm-hmm. It always varies depending on where I'm at in my life.
Right.
3 years ago when I did The Great Society, I was just very happy to do a Broadway show, to be honest.
Right.
I was like, oh my God, my first Broadway show. I was so excited. And then I learned what it was, and I was like, oh my God, my first Broadway show. you know, not in a bad way, but just like, you're like, there's a sort of, we have an honest conversation right now, Janine. There's a sort of demystifying once you get there, where you're like, oh, this is a different monster. Even once, like, the difference between Great Society and the experience now and even the next experience. And I mean, there have been shows in between that where I said no. And the reason I said no is because once you do it once, you're like, oh, I know what this is.
Right.
And now I know what I need for myself in order to do this every time. And it's not about being selfish or diva. It's actually about taking care of yourself.
Yes.
And understanding how to bring your best self to the work.
Exactly.
I hope that answers. So, like, whenever I choose anything, I think of it as two of those three things have to be in play. People play pay. Because if two of those things aren't in play, then I won't be able to bring my best self to the work. That's a long-winded way of saying the thing. But
no, you're good. You're good.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
So I saw Ain't No Mo just this past Sunday, and you play several characters, and it reminded me of Eddie Murphy.
Oh my God!
And I'm thinking of, like, Morbid, and I'm thinking of The Nutty Professor, and it's like, except he's doing it on screen, and you're doing it live in an audience, multiple transitions, multiple looks, multiple wardrobe changes, and I was just like, okay, I love it. I love it. How do you mentally prepare yourself?
First of all,
to put on all those hats in one, I'm like, you've got to be taxed.
Yo, first of all, Janine, I just have to say I love you. Eddie, you know, Eddie, I hope, Eddie, maybe you listen to this and we can work together someday. But Eddie is like I don't want to say idols because I try not to idolize humans.
Life goal.
Yeah. I love me some Eddie Murphy. I love me some Eddie Murphy. And you're not the first person to come to the show and say that, which is really funny.
Well, because it's really real. It's really
and the director
real.
Says
and
it,
if you're listening, go.
The director says this. He said, "What's up, little Eddie?" He calls me that when we're rehearsing. It is a marathon. To prepare for that thing, I mean, you can't see it right now, but in my dressing room, you know, I got my my steamer, and I have like three packs of Ricola back there. Downstairs, they on stage, they put like a hook for me because I have a gallon of water that I drink throughout the show because it is it's a marathon. It's a marathon. I mean, it's like our life as actors in this business. It's not a race. It's a marathon. So I have to pace myself throughout the show. Even the way I prepare, it's like down to a science now in order to be able to do it for 100 minutes, you know? But so I have, there's playlists that I have that get me into it. Then there's like, once you're doing it, they're like, I built like benchmarks for myself. It's like, once you, the wonderful thing about acting is that we have the craft, you know, stage acting, at least we have the craft and we can build a performance. And so I've built within the performance benchmarks for myself backstage of where I need a reset, or where I need, like, there are tissues at this spot because I know I'm going to come off stage crying here, or there might be some stuff that I need to wipe away. And then there's a quick change where I got to be back on stage in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
There are towels here. I have a water bottle on this side and my tea on the other side of the stage for that transition. I have unwrapped cough drops here and here. It's like it's a marathon. And then it's funny, I check in with my castmates before the show. And then, like, during transitions, because it's so fast, there's no time to do that. So it's like, it's always like, it's alive, man. It's alive. It's a living organism. It's one of those pieces where you come and you're in the audience and you're seeing it for the first time, for the only time, and for the last time, you know, every single time. And for me, that's really exciting.
As an audience member, I went through a barrage of emotions. It was laughter. Mm-hmm. It was joy. Like, yeah, there was that pride. I mean, it's satire, really. Yeah. You're looking at the racial tropes and exposing them. One of the scenes that I can't stop talking about is when blackness is set free. And I am just like, oh, we could do a masterclass just on that scene alone. And how we have evolved as a people from when we were first brought over to where we're at now, post George Floyd's murder. What, if any, scene would you say is one that sits with you the most?
Oh, that's so tough. That's really tough.
And you're like, I like them all because I'm invested in all of them.
That sits with me the most. I think for me, one of the scenes, I love the opening because of the fact that I think there's a realization that I had while doing this show or rehearsing, which is Black Lives Matter didn't become a thing until after Obama's presidency. And so it's one of the most, I think it's one of the things where we're listening and we're like, yeah, we're laughing. People have thoughts, people are frustrated, people are angry. But when you think about the situation, Black Lives Matter, the movement, was not brought into the forefront of society until Obama's presidency.
Right.
And so there was this hope and this promise and this belief, you know, I remember my grandma, when she, this belief that things would change, you know, we had this generation, I don't even know what you call my grandma's generation, but the folks who were around during the civil rights movement and like got to see this thing happen in society that they never believed would happen. In fact, they thought the man would be shot down before he even got to the White House. I think we all had that fear. And then it happens, and the promise of, like, the American dream is still sort of like a dream deferred, you know?
Exactly. Yes, Langston Hughes, yes.
And so it's, I think for me, it's one of the most potent moments in the play because it's one of the most deceptively... It's one of the most deceptive moments in the play because I think people look at it and listen and think are thinking one thing and are feeling one thing because what they're being asked to do and what's happening. And then it isn't till later once you start to have conversations where you're like, wait, but I mean, I think they see it and they're like, oh, it's this one thing. And I was like, no, it's actually greater than just this one thing, right? I think that moment, it's that moment in the play in which I realized that, like, in which we realized that there's a major flaw in the system.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that one man is not going to save it.
No, no. I understand, you know, obviously you have your current role, ain't no mo. you talked about your upcoming, role, for Good Night Oscar.
Yes.
In addition to that, you have a children's book coming out in January.
A Boy and His Mirror. Yes.
Can you talk about both of those things?
Yeah, I could talk about both of those things. So, well, the book was a combination of things. It was sort of my small effort to sort of counter toxic masculinity in the Black community. It's my belief that we do feel so we can heal.
Yes.
And it is my belief that in our softness we are strong, and in our strength we are soft. And it's demonstrated through Chris's, the protagonist's, ability to talk through his issues with other kids by the end of the book. One of the other things that was really important to me in writing this book is highlighting the power of Black women. Throughout the book, we see the impact of these Black women on Chris, the woman in the mirror, his mom, giving him this great space to grow and just be. And so it's just important to put those images out in the world. Couturia Bobo, who is a New York Times bestseller for I Am Enough, Grace Byers' book, has done a brilliant job at bringing those images to life and really showing them, giving it such detail and love. And so I'm excited to share this offering with people, in hopes that, somebody might see themselves. Somebody might feel, somebody might see that mirror and feel, more inclined to just be.
Yeah. That is awesome. I'm looking for it. Comes what, January? Is it January 3rd?
Yes, it comes out January 3rd, 2023. But it is available for pre-order wherever books are sold. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, okay. Target, Walmart, Indie Books.
Okay. Awesome.
Yes.
Awesome.
And that is...
What age would you say?
K to 2. But my hope is that anybody would read it and feel sort of moved or feel... the message, I read a children's book called The Monster at the End of This Book about Grover and how he's putting up walls. He reads at the beginning of the book, there's a monster at the end of the book. So he puts up walls. He builds walls out of concrete, out of brick, only to find out that the monster at the end of the book is him. I think that message resonates with most people. And I believe it is my belief that this one will as well.
That's awesome. And then when does Good Night Oscar?
Yes, Good Night Oscar starts the day after I finish this bad boy. So we will we'll
at least you won't have to travel far.
Not be right in the same room. I am a permanent fixture here at the Belasco. Dave Belasco would be proud. Or mad, I don't know.
He'd be proud.
Be proud.
I'm proud.
Yes, so that begins April 7th is when we start previews. I believe it opens April 24th. There's a film that I just did that's in the can with Sydney Sweeney and Josh Hamilton called Reality, based off the Broadway play Is This a Room?
Yeah.
And that should be hitting the festival circuit sometime. Well, it will be hitting the festival circuit in the new year.
Okay, booked and busy for real.
Yeah.
That was not, seriously, you got a lot going on. Well, I like to always end with one final question at the end of each podcast. Mm-hmm. We ask our guest, what is one piece of advice you'd like to share with the Black future leaders of Broadway?
Woo! Cha, 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 cha. Be louder than your fear, faster than your worry, moving at the speed of fun. I'm going to say that one more time for the people who didn't catch it. Be louder than your fear, faster than your worry, moving at the speed of fun.
Oh my God, I love it. Thank you. And thank you, thank you, thank you for coming on the podcast. Thank you for sharing your story. I am sure someone out there has been touched and moved by your words. And I am so grateful. I want to thank our guests and you, our listeners. You could have been doing anything else, but you chose to spend your time with me, and I am grateful. Be sure to subscribe at bpn.fm/BBB so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, tell a friend. I'm your host, Janine Scott, and we at the Broadway League hope you enjoyed this episode of The Black Business of Broadway.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.